Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of what is behind the House Republicans' political brinkmanship. American University historian Alan Lichtman, the author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, joins us to explain the source of the dysfunction on Capitol Hill, which appears to be the blind and unbridled ambition of Eric Cantor, who wants to become the next speaker. Then we'll look into the appalling foreclosure scandal that has millions of Americans homeless while millions of homes sit empty. William K. Black joins us. He was the chief litigator who put hundreds of bank fraudsters in jail after the savings and loan scandal of the 1980s, and we'll look into the efforts by the Obama administration and state's attorney generals to indemnify the banks involved in the recent subprime housing fraud that almost tanked the global economy. With the attorney generals of California, New York, and Delaware still resisting this trillion-dollar slap on the wrist, we will attempt to find out why people who could pay a fair price for housing are kept out of empty and abandoned homes they once occupied. Then finally, we'll assess whether there will be a change in the dismal state of deteriorating relations between the U.S. and Pakistan following the announcement by the Pentagon that mistakes were made by NATO that resulted in the recent deaths of 24 Pakistani soldiers. Suja Nawaz, the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within, joins us to address the tensions between the two erstwhile allies and the warnings by Pakistan's Prime Minister that conspirators are plotting to bring down the Pakistan civilian government and there will be no state within a state. Obvious references to the military and its powerful intelligence service, the ISI. Let's now discuss the behind-the-scenes power struggle in the House that resulted in the latest standoff. I spoke with Alan Lichtman just before news broke a short while ago that John Boehner was caving in and would allow the House to vote on the Senate bill, a humiliation for Boehner, who appears to have been set up for the fall by Eric Cantor. Joining us now is Alan Lichtman, a professor of history at American University, who studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And if the election were held today, what would happen? I mean, there's nothing more dysfunctional and embarrassing about the nature of these continuing deadlocks that seem to be engineered by the Tea Party caucus of the Republican House. We had the almost shutdown of the U.S. government and the destruction of the full faith and credit of the United States unless they got their way. And this seems to be their M.O., What's your understanding of what's behind this?
Well, first of all, regardless of the shenanigans among Republicans in the Congress, the keys to the White House have been pointing to an Obama victory for the past year and a half. Yes, he has the economy out against him, but almost everything else is going for him. He's the sitting president. He won't be challenged in his own party. There's no third-party split. He had big foreign policy triumphs with Gaddafi and bin Laden. He's not been hit by scandal. The nation is not falling apart from social unrest. He doesn't face a charismatic challenger. All those things are going for Obama. And now the Republicans in Congress are making absolutely, positively certain that Obama seals the deal with the American people. It's utterly remarkable when the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal should come out and say that the Republicans in Congress are doing all that they possibly could do to make sure that Obama gets reelected. You know, the approval rating of Congress is already below that of Attila the Hun. It's almost in single digits. It's hard to imagine it could sink even more. But they've now forfeited, perhaps, the one issue that's been a staple of Republicans ever since Ronald Reagan in 1980, and that's taxes. They have made two huge mistakes on taxes. Number one, opposing the millionaire tax, which the great majority of Americans support. And number two, tying things up to make it so difficult and maybe impossible to extend the payroll tax that gives about $1,000 in tax breaks to average, ordinary Americans. For the first time that I can recall in this administration, maybe since the first few months, all of a sudden the American people now trust Obama more than the Republicans on taxes.
Well, I'm surprised, though, that the president and the Republicans weren't able to make more and, or at least clarified in the real nature of the House Republicans' hypocrisy, or the Republicans in general, being for every tax cut except when it comes to the middle class and 160 million working Americans. Now, the president did finally make that case today, appearing with average working Americans, where he spoke with a note of disgust towards the Congress. But, you know, tacking on the Keystone Pipeline was such a flagrant way to get political cover when it all comes down to the fact that the Republicans, at least in the House, will not fund the extension of the payroll tax cuts by a modest levy on millionaires and billionaires. The Democrats dropped that, though. That's what I don't understand, Alan.
Well, you know, the Democrats are a bit enthralled to the millionaires and the billionaires themselves. But as you say, Obama now has begun to make that argument, and he's got plenty of time to make it between now and next November. And you'll hear it time and again that the Republicans are not really for tax cuts. They're only for tax breaks in the top, you know, 1%, 2%, or 3%. They only care about helping their millionaire friends and not ordinary Americans when it comes to tax cuts. Not only did they balk at the millionaire tax increase to fund the payroll tax reduction, they won't even agree to a two-month extension of the payroll tax cut so that you can negotiate a more long-term cut. So they're on the wrong side of the issue in a double-edged way. Plus, they seem utterly divided and utterly dysfunctional. You now see Mitch McConnell, the Republican minority leader in the Senate, publicly coming out and chastising the House leadership for not being able to get this tax cut deal done in the House. And you see John Boehner, the Republican Speaker of the House, absolutely impotent, hapless, held in thrall by the extreme right-wing Tea Party group of his Republican Party, which now seems to have found its spokesperson in Eric Cantor of Virginia.
Well, isn't that what this game is about? I mean, I was wondering whether Eric Cantor had lost his mind, because he's clearly pushing this showdown, and he is the darling of the, well, at least he's got the Tea Party caucus in his pocket. And I would have thought, you know, what's this man doing? He's going to go down in flames. But it's clear what he's doing. He's going to have Boehner go down in flames, right? Boehner's the one that's going to have to make the humiliating retreat from how they box themselves in. So
that's right. Boehner's the leader. Boehner's the guy on the spot. And Cantor doesn't have all that much to lose. And if Boehner does go down in flames, then, you know, Cantor could become the next speaker, although they seem to be doing everything possible to make sure that it'll be a Democratic speaker come 2013, because these shenanigans are certainly not going to do anything to help Republican candidates in the swing seats. Obviously, the right-wingers in the heavily Republican seats, but a lot of those Republicans, as a result of 2010, are in precarious seats.
So, Alan Lichtman, is this blind ambition on Cantor's part?
I think it absolutely is blind ambition and blind ideology on the part of those lemmings that he's leading off the cliff. That is, there is now an element of the Republican Party, which, you know, they're legislators. And you know, the very act of being a legislator means you've got to give and take, negotiate, and compromise. But these folks don't have a compromising, negotiating bone in their body. It's our way or no way.
Again, Alan Lichtman is a professor of history at American University who studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. And his prediction system has correctly predicted the outcome of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. When former House Speaker Newt Gingrich goes public and urges Boehner to cut a deal, I must say you realize they're in terrible trouble, because in many ways it was Gingrich that brought this combative, take no prisoner, scorched earth kind of approach to the legislative process that the Tea Parties have amped up 1,000 degrees. But does that strike you as a great irony?
It is a great irony, because this is Gingrichism run amok. Remember, it was Newt Gingrich who pushed the government to shut down back in 1995, who was talking about disloyal Americans and who are real Americans, overreaching with his rhetoric, with his policies. And of course, ultimately, Bill Clinton won handily in his reelection bid in 1996. And Bill Clinton was even left standing after the impeachment controversy. But who was dismissed? Newt Gingrich.
So I noticed, Alan Lichtman, that when Barney Frank gave his kind of farewell press conference as he's retiring from the Congress, he made a remark which really caught my attention, and that he said that you can't work with the Republicans anymore, that basically, in the House, because he's obviously in the House, he says that they're either, they think like Michelle Bachmann, or if they don't think like Michelle Bachmann, they're afraid that they have to go along with Michelle Bachmann's agenda, otherwise Michelle Bachmann will run against him in the next primary. How does that strike you as a description of the House?
Well, I think it's a fairly accurate description that is borne out by the fact that the House does not seem to be willing to compromise and negotiate on anything. We see that in the Senate, too. In fact, if you look at the Obama health care bill, that was the only major piece of social legislation in the history of the country to be passed without a single opposition vote. That was certainly a signal of things to come. And now we've seen that taken to the ultimate extreme in the House. On the one hand, you might think, all right, they want to defeat Obama, so they don't want to give him anything. But as the Wall Street Journal editorial pointed out, they seem to be intent only on defeating themselves. This can't even be explained by opposition to Barack Obama. It can only be explained by the most rigid ideological purity that, you know, we are going to insist that everything has to bear our stamp or nothing gets done.
So you suggested earlier, Alan Lichtman, that this is all but guaranteeing President Obama's re-election. You did mention that he has no opposition. There is this third-party effort that's well-funded by a billionaire, Peter Ackerman. It's called Americans Elect. It's going to operate online, and people will vote online for their presidential candidate. They've qualified for a number of ballots around the country, including California. So is that a factor? I mean,
it could be, but you got to have a candidate. It's very, very difficult to mount a third-party campaign in this country. Even Ralph Nader, a national hero for many, a household name, could only garner 2.7% of the popular vote. That's extraordinary. Without a candidate and without a, you know, strong platform like Ross Perot had when he was pushing the deficit and political corruption, it would be very, very difficult to mount a third-party campaign. Even to get on the ballot in all the states is going to be extremely difficult. But a movement without a candidate and without even a lot more money than is even being put into it right now is not going to upset this race.
So what do you think of the idea of going online and typing in your vote as if it's, you're voting for Dancing for the Stars, you know?
Well, so, you know, Dancing for the Stars, American Idol, get a lot of votes, and this might get a lot of people typing in online, but it's not likely to get very many votes at the polls.
Well, also, apparently, Peter Ackerman and his group that are running Americans Elect, they ultimately decide on who the candidates are, I believe.
Of course they do. There's no democratic process for choosing the candidate, and that's going to turn off most of the American people. Boy, you know, you could resurrect Ronald Reagan and put him up as a third-party candidate, and he'd have a tough time.
So just back to the Republican dysfunction, trying to understand their motivations. The Tea Party, of course, came out of disgust with Wall Street, and I think the Democrats ceded an enormous issue there by not tapping into the outrage the American people felt about the bailouts. That's, another chapter of
it is,
which we don't have time to get into. But the fact that they picked it up and ran with it, but then they seem to have been captured by the Koch money, and a couple of political pros, Karl Rove and Dick Armey, managed the movement. But they sure got a lot of people elected in 2010. So what happened in 2010 that you think is not going to happen in 2012?
Well, midterm elections and presidential elections run on entirely different rhythms. What happened in 2010 was the people who were motivated to vote were those who wanted to make a statement against Barack Obama, who kind of wanted to vote no. Just like in 2006, those who really wanted to vote were those who wanted to vote no on George W. Bush. Presidential election is entirely different because there is no no vote. There is a choice between two candidates, and that poses an entirely different problem for the voter. So I don't think you can base anything about 2012 on 2010. In fact, the three presidents since World War II who lost control of Congress during their administrations in the midterms all went on to win the next election: Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, and Bill Clinton. So you can't judge on that. Plus, the Tea Party is very different now. Tea Party is no longer an independent movement. As mostly happens with independent movements, it has gotten co-opted by a major party, in this case, the Republican Party. The Tea Party is now part of the Republican Party. It's not a nonpartisan independent movement, if it ever was.
Well, when you said earlier, Alan Lichtman, that the Tea Party zealots, I guess is a fair way to put it, are driven by ideology, when I mentioned the funding by the Kochs and their capture by Dick Armey and Karl Rove, their legislative priorities have been clearly those of the plutocrats. I mean, they've gone to the mat for millionaires and billionaires. This whole payroll tax cut standoff comes down to the fact that they would not allow, and the Democrats folded, but they would not entertain the idea of a modest surtax on millionaires and billionaires. When they threatened to shut down the government earlier, it was again over the same issues, whether to tax millionaires and billionaires. So are they really fraudulent in the sense that they seem to be carrying the water for the Kochs?
I think they're fraudulent populists. But then again, my book, White Protestant Nation, points out that the conservative movement has always been a pro-business movement ever since the modern conservative movement was founded after World War One. Its two cardinal core values were preserving private business, conserving private business, and conserving what they regard as traditional social values. So the fact that the Tea Party is very much carrying water for American big business is absolutely consistent with the last 100 years of conservative history. People are utterly misled when they say what conservatism represents is limited government or fiscal responsibility, and that's what the Tea Party is all about. Nonsense. The biggest spender in the history of the country, the biggest bureaucratic builder in the history of the world, was one of our most conservative presidents, George W. Bush. Both liberals and conservatives want to spend. They might spend it on different things, liberals on environmental programs and social programs, conservatives on homeland security, the military, police forces, border control, but they all want to spend. That has nothing to do with fiscal conservatism or limited government whatsoever. And never underestimate the importance of the social issues for the right as well. Look what happened to Rick Perry, in part because of that modest little program to help the children of immigrants in Texas. So absolutely, it is no surprise that the Tea Party should be carrying the water for American business.
Well, just in closing, Alan Lichtman, we mentioned earlier that the Tea Party were the first to run with the outrage on Wall Street. The Democrats and the White House dropped the ball on that issue, and they were able to translate that anger into the polls, electorally picking up, I think, 70 or so seats in the House and changing the very nature of the Republican House and essentially capturing the national agenda. Do you think that on the other side of the political spectrum, the Occupy movement that is largely on the left of the spectrum, having spoken to a number of occupiers around the country, they are zealously against the Democratic Party in large. So how can that, the 99% message, can that translate electorally?
I don't think so. I think it would be very difficult to take the Occupy Wall Street message and translate it electorally. And those folks are right. The Democratic Party, less than the Republican Party, I'll say that. But the Democratic Party is also very much a party heavily influenced by business interests, business donors, and is certainly not ready to take on Wall Street and adopt a full-throated left-wing populist position. It never has throughout its history. Even the Roosevelt administration, while bitterly opposed by business, probably did more for business than any administration in the history of the country.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alan Lichtman.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a professor of history at American University, who studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break and be back in a moment talking about the $1 trillion slap on the wrist for bank foreclosure fraud.
Nothing but a dirty, dirty old man. You do your thinking with a one-track mind. Keep talking about heaven, glory, but on your face is a different story. Clean up your rap, your story's getting dusty. Wash out your mouth, your lies are getting rusty. Can't believe nothing you say. Since I'm around and I see what you do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William K. Black, who's the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007. And he's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And the Occupy movement in this country is morphing somewhat into Occupy Our Homes. And I spoke with a couple of activists recently who were out in the Inland Empire here in Southern California. There are just blocks and blocks and streets of foreclosed homes. And they were trying to prevent the eviction of a family from one home and support the reoccupation of an empty home that had been foreclosed on, where the owner went back in after it had sat idle for 6 months. And the neighborhood people really supported them. And it seems to me that maybe that is a good political movement for this Occupy movement, to show solidarity with homeowners. What's your sense of whether that is a viable direction?
It's a tricky one. Certainly, supporting people against eviction has tremendous support, and there are recent reports, for example, by a county clerk in Massachusetts who actually studied foreclosures. His report says that upwards of 70% of the foreclosure actions there were unlawful. So we certainly strongly support people not being evicted illegally, and they unquestionably need help because they are overwhelmingly, of course, people that cannot afford lawyers. So this is an area in which the bar and local law schools could be tremendously helpful in terms of their legal clinics in bringing some of these actions that would not just be retail, in other words, individuals, but a whole course of conduct on the illegal foreclosures and the good old MERS process, which is so controversial and has been ruled illegal in some places and lawful in some other places. So there's a split in the courts on that. In terms of coming back and taking somebody else, the house, that was owned by somebody else or was owned previously by you, that can have some pretty significant criminal penalties. So, you know, that's a much more difficult strategy to use.
Well, what struck me, though, was that these activists were telling me that the people in the neighborhood were so supportive, because empty houses brings a blight on their neighborhood, brings the possibility of crime, and more importantly, lowers the property values of everybody in the neighborhood. And it would seem to me that Isn't this a national shame that you've got, I think, an almost equal number of homeless people to the number of empty homes?
This is a national scandal, and you're precisely correct that it's self-destructive. This harms all property values, and it isn't just property values. Neighborhoods deteriorate in other ways in terms of vermin, in terms of theft, in terms of even drugs and such. So it's a terrible thing leaving these homes unoccupied while you have in large millions of people being homeless, and it's a complete failure of public policy. There should be a rental assistance program to get people in. I mean, one of the problems is we got lots of folks who simply cannot afford the houses in terms of purchase. But that doesn't mean that you couldn't be renting and at least reduce the bank losses and helping the neighborhood. And here's what the localities could do that could be very helpful. They could pass ordinances requiring that banks that keep unoccupied homes pay a very substantial cost in terms of additional fees and taxes for that. Once that continues for more than a month or two, that would be normal for a sale, and that would tremendously encourage them to get these properties resold or rented in productive ways that would help the neighborhoods.
Well, William K. Black, again, the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s, you put a lot of bank executives in jail, and of course, nobody's gone to jail for the great 2008 subprime housing bubble crash and the extent to which the entire global economy had a near-death experience, and that grates on a lot of people. So I guess the broader question here is, has anybody come up with a creative approach to deal with this totally dysfunctional situation where you've got a lot of homeless people, a lot of empty property? You've got people in these houses that could pay a reasonable mortgage, but they're being kicked out because they can't service these criminal liar's loan mortgages that they were signed up for. I just don't understand why no political authority or legal authority, and I know the California Attorney General and some of the attorney generals are fighting back against forgiving the banks on all of this. So give me a sense of what's lacking here in dealing with this problem that seems to be basically easy to solve.
Well, one thing that's lacking is a spine in the federal government. And what you have going on, and people really need to not only know about this, but to act now, and I mean now within the next 10 days, to be writing Attorney General Harris and Attorney General Schneiderman in New York and their attorney generals in whatever state they're in, and demanding that this proposed settlement not go forward of the sort of global settlement that the Obama administration, HUD's Housing and Urban Development, and a number of state attorney generals led by Attorney General Miller of Iowa are trying to do, that would immunize the banks for over $1 trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion. Over $1 trillion in the origination of fraudulent mortgages. That is the greatest scandal in the legal system in our history, at least involving money, by far, this attempted giveaway. And they are actively trying and pressuring the Attorney General of California and New York and Delaware to give up their opposition and to sign on to this formal surrender to crony capitalism. So if we went forward with those criminal cases, we could get immense recoveries in the tens of billions of dollars, far more than proposed in this settlement, that would help out housing. That's one thing we could do. A second thing is what I've just mentioned, that there should be ordinances that charge much, much higher fees on people who leave these houses vacant and allow the neighborhoods to deteriorate. That would push them back into occupation, being occupied either by renters or owners, and that would be tremendous for the neighborhood. Dean Baker, the economist, has a creative program for converting mortgages that are impossible to meet for, you know, a number of folks into rental arrangements. That could be done. It would be very good for the world. Of course, the passage of the extension on the not collecting the Social Security payment, it would be tremendously important, as would the extension of the long-term unemployment benefits. If the those extensions are killed, which the Republicans at this juncture are voting to do, then that will cause many more foreclosures.
Apparently, Boehner has just come across the wires now that John Boehner is willing to put it up to a vote. So I think the impasse might be over.
He said that and he flipped 2 days ago, so we'll believe it when we see it.
Right. Well, what I don't understand, though, William K. Black, again, the former litigation director for the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, investigated the savings and loan disaster in the 1980s. He was the director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention, and he's the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. You've just told us that essentially the Obama administration have already capitulated to the banks. Most states' attorney generals have, in terms of immunizing them to the tune of, what, $1 trillion, and only three standouts, the attorney generals of California, New York, and Delaware, urging people to write in support of the stand that they're taking. Why did the White House capitulate on this?
Oh, campaign contributions and this absurd fear spread by the industry and by Treasury Secretary Geithner that says we can't crack down on the criminals because they're so powerful and the banking industry has been so destroyed by their frauds that if we even investigated, much less prosecuted, see, they're actually trying to prevent even the investigation of the $1 trillion in mortgage fraud, that if we even look at them, funny, they collapse. And so they're holding the economy hostage under this theory. Now, that's absurd. I mean, the idea that you get economic stability by leaving the frauds in charge as CEO when they just caused this crisis is so Looney Tunes that only the Obama and Bush administrations could possibly believe it. But anyway, the deal is not done in the other states, and it may never be done because of the size of California, New York, and Delaware, of course, is the major incorporation state. So if we can hang tough in those three states, they may not go forward with a deal, and if we can chip back against the attorney generals, who might otherwise follow the lead of the Obama administration. Notice Republicans, this is the season where their candidates, of course, are running for the nomination, and they're bashing Obama on all kinds of things, but you don't see them bashing him on this. You don't see Republican attorney generals saying, no, that's a terrible Democratic thing, you know, that this guy is too close to the industry and such. It's very interesting, the Republican silence as well as the Obama silence.
So the banks own them all. Wasn't that what Senator Dick Durbin said in disgust one day in the U.S. Senate? The bank owns this place?
That's exactly what they're saying. And, of course, finance is the leading source of political contributions to both parties. But it's time for the media in every interview to demand answers to these things from not just the Democrats but the Republicans, and it's time for the public to make these demands in town hall meetings and such.
Well, just in closing, my understanding is that the fraud continues, not just the fraud that brought about these liar's loans and brought about the subprime bubble and the near-death experience of the global economy, but a lot of banks apparently were then forced, because these loans were so dodgy, they outsourced the forging of documents to justify their ownership. and they've been throwing people out on the streets who could service the debt. There's something strange and cruel about it that I don't get. I don't understand why they would take such losses. Now, maybe a lot of it is this collusion where they do short sales on houses to people that they know, and everybody does well, but it's a terribly depressed market now. You think the real estate lobby would be pushing for some justice here?
Well, you're quite correct that the frauds continued, and it shouldn't be any surprise. After all, Bank of America, for example, went out and acquired the most notorious fraudulent lender in the world, Countrywide, and then put those people in charge of foreclosures. Well, what do you think they're going to do? But the other discouraging news, which is just run in the L.A. Times, is that home sales, it turns out, were greatly overstated by the National Association of Realtors, and they've just admitted this. And so things are actually worse in housing than we thought, and we thought they were very bad.
Well, Bill Black, I thank you for joining us here today to sort of get some clarity on this, something that I find so bothersome. You know, it's so cruel to see so many families suffering here unnecessarily, and yet all these empty homes. There's something so deeply wrong with that picture. I'm grateful for your input.
You mean we should be talking about this instead of Christmas cards?
Okay.
From the White House, the real Christmas spirit might be something to do with whether people were being evicted through fraud. Happy New Year to you and all your listeners.
Thanks a lot. I've been speaking with William K. Black, who is a former litigation director for the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and he's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the U.S. military and NATO are now apologizing to the Pakistanis for killing 24 soldiers.
Some people say we've already lost.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Shuja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. Shuja Nawaz is a native of Pakistan who's worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was the director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. He is currently the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
And a couple of developments in Pakistan. The Pentagon has now expressed its deepest regret for the loss of lives. 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed recently in a clash on the border. Obviously, a lot of anger inside Pakistan. Initially, U.S. reports said that they had contacted the GHQ, the Pakistani authorities, and given them the coordinates of where the battle was and where they were going to strike. And Pakistan military agreed to that. And that was the reason why the president hadn't apologized. But now it seems that, in fact, the U.S. gave the Pakistan military the wrong coordinates. Is that your understanding?
That appears to be the case. I'm still waiting for the transcript to be posted by the Department of Defense later today. But from the reports at the briefing, it appears that they gave the wrong coordinates because they were using the wrong map template. That was the explanation given by them. There's also a basic issue of mistrust on both sides, as a result of which the United States forces in Afghanistan do not normally share a lot of detailed information with their Pakistani counterparts, and that may have led them into fudging some of the information. But the Pakistani narrative, as you know, has been quite set for the past 3 weeks on this issue, and they maintain that the standard operating procedures that have been mutually agreed for operations close to the border have four main components, that there will be sharing of detailed information about impending operations on both sides, regardless of the size of the operations on the border. In case there's firing from one side on the other, friendly fire, and there should be immediate sharing of information about the point of origin of that fire so that they can take responsibility. And then they're supposed to stop firing the moment communication is established. And then the fourth is that if there is a request for supporting actions from the other side, then that operational request is to be complied with. I think this is designed in order to chase bad guys from one side of the border to the other. And it looks as if that, the standard operating procedures were not followed.
But a part of the standard operating procedures, should you know us, is that NATO does not inform Pakistan of operations in advance because they don't trust the Pakistan military to leak the information to the insurgents. I mean, that's not a stated policy, but that seems to be a fact, isn't it?
As I said, this is part of the deep inherent distrust on both sides. But the procedures, my understanding is, have generally been followed, particularly in the border region, particularly inside Afghanistan when there have been previous ISAF or NATO operations that the Pakistanis have been informed that there will be troops in such and such area. Another reason for the confusion this time apparently was a conflict between the American narrative and the Pakistani narrative on this attack. The Pakistanis maintained that the U.S. was aware of these two border posts. The U.S. Apparently is saying that these were relatively new posts and they had not been made aware of their location.
Well, couldn't they see them? They're about 300 meters from the Afghan border.
They could see them in the sense that this was the middle of the night. And they could see where the fire was coming from, and they could see some rudimentary stone structures on top of two hills. But it's hard to see whether this is the fire is coming from Pakistani military weapons or from some other source. So that's understandable. However, when you call in air support, it is normally understood that you convey to your aircraft, which apparently was supporting the Afghan slash NATO operation in that region, you convey to them your own GPS location as well as the location from where the fire is coming. And that apparently was, that information was available to the Border Coordination Center at a place called Nawa. But that was not conveyed to the Pakistanis. What was conveyed to them was a wrong coordinate, which was 15 kilometers from where the Pakistani posts were located.
And what are the ground rules vis-a-vis the U.S. using artillery or bombs? And I take it in this case these were aircraft dropping bombs on Pakistani territory.
I don't think there are any written understandings on that. It's understood that this is in the area of friendly fire, which is why the earlier SOPs that I mentioned, the standard operating procedures that I mentioned, say that the moment one side conveys to the other that fire seems to be coming on our posts from your side, you're supposed to stop before you proceed. That means verifying who is on the other side.
So what do you think will be the response in Pakistan, Shuja Nawaz, of this apology from the Pentagon?
First of all, I don't think it'll be seen as an apology. Among other things, 3 weeks have gone by, which may have been behind the thinking at the Pentagon and at the higher echelons of the U.S. government, that if you let things go by, perhaps the rhetoric and the emotions will die down. So we have to wait to see if that actually was a successful strategy. I suspect not, because the domestic situation inside Pakistan has been pretty volatile in the last few weeks because of reasons other than this attack, but related to U.S.-Pakistan relations. There was this case of the so-called memo gate, where there's an alleged memo written on behalf of the senior members of the government of Pakistan, reportedly, to Admiral Mike Mullen to put pressure on the army so that it wouldn't carry out a coup in the wake of the attack that killed Osama bin Laden. And that has created a huge political firestorm inside Pakistan, as well as drawn the attention of the Supreme Court. So the anti-U.S. rhetoric has been mounting, and the military and the government on this particular case of the firing on the Pakistani posts in the border region have taken a very public and strong stance against the United States. It'll be hard for them to walk it back anytime soon. Maybe they'll have to find a decent interval before they start rolling back some of the measures that they've taken against the U.S.
Well, the measures that they've taken against the U.S., the one that particularly hurts, surely, is cutting off supplies to NATO and ISAF in Afghanistan, since Pakistan is the main conduit for the supplies. Where does that stand, the huge logjam of all those trucks that go through?
That logjam exists, and it's obviated somewhat by the fact that the U.S. had been storing supplies in Afghanistan in anticipation of some similar activity on the part of the Pakistanis. But the longer the blockade of the ground lines of communication continues, the more difficult the situation becomes, because most of the heavy fighting equipment as well as the fuel comes through Pakistan. The interesting point is that the air supply route, the air line of communication, is still open, and the Pakistanis have not said anything about that. So clearly there's an opportunity there to reopen discussions so that in addition to the air route, the ground route can be opened up. The closing of the ground route actually affects Pakistan also, and I'm sure there will be a price that they will be paying for it. Already the port at Karachi has been completely blocked because many of the shipments were already on their way to Pakistan, and there's no room for the ships or the containers in Karachi Harbor, which is affecting the operations of the Karachi port for Pakistan's own trade.
And surely there's also a lot of employment, isn't there, for drivers and...
Exactly. But yeah. The U.S. Apparently feels that, you know, it doesn't have a huge loss on that side, because they actually don't pay for the fuel till it crosses the border into Afghanistan. So, yes, the employment effects of this on the people involved in transporting the material is going to be pretty bad. But the U.S. doesn't suffer any out-of-pocket till the fuel is actually delivered. What the U.S. will need is the resupply of the heavy equipment.
Again, I'm speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. Now, the U.S. Congress recently cut off, I think, $600 or $700 million of aid to Pakistan because they were unhappy with Pakistan's efforts in curtailing the shipment of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which is the main ingredient, along with diesel, in the improvised explosive device, the IEDs, that are the main cause of casualties for U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan. Where does that stand?
There's obviously a reaction against that from Pakistan. The official word was that Pakistan was being singled out, that the fertilizer that is being mentioned is produced in a number of countries surrounding Afghanistan, including Iran, including Central Asia. and that all of those supplies and those supply routes are open and are also flowing into Afghanistan. My understanding is that there has been a fair amount of discussion between U.S. military authorities and Pakistanis, as well as the two manufacturing plants in Pakistan that produce fertilizer, to find out ways in which identifying markers, for instance, could be put in the fertilizer so that it could be tracked, as well as to change its composition in such a way that it cannot be easily used in the IEDs manufactured inside Afghanistan. I think that conversation is continuing. So this is perhaps Congress taking a few steps ahead of the administration and the Department of Defense.
So, Shuja Nawaz, you mentioned Memogate, and I remember years ago interviewing Mansoor Ejaz on a number of occasions. He's the character in between who makes somewhat grandiose claims about his connections to the Pakistani elite. He seems to be the source of this leak that's embarrassed the government and resulted in the sacking, I guess, of Pakistan's ambassador to the United States, who, by all accounts, was a very able diplomat. Where does that stand? Because one of the things that I find extraordinary is that Prime Minister Gilani just spoke. He was at an art gallery, but he spoke very provocatively to the press, saying that there can be no state within a state and that conspirators are plotting to bring down Pakistan's civilian government. Well, I mean, clearly that is directed at the military and the ISI, I imagine.
Absolutely. Pakistan remains a political house divided. And on Memogate itself, there are now two parallel lines of inquiry. There is one in response to a petition from former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif that the Supreme Court has taken up, and that's the one that has garnered much of the headlines. And the other is a parliamentary committee that is headed by a member of the Pakistan People's Party of President Zardari and Prime Minister Gilani that has now launched its own inquiry and has asked among others, the army chief and the head of the inter-services intelligence to come and testify in person or in writing. So this is a game that is very much afoot. It's not clear who benefits from this, because if the aim is to somehow change the government or to remove President Zardari, then if Mr. Zardari goes, the Pakistan People's Party will splinter extremely badly. And the people that will escape from the party will run to Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's party or to the new party of Imran Khan, the former cricketer. But Pakistani politics is not going to be very strong because even if there is a fresh election, the mandate is not going to be there for any single individual or any single party. The People's Party, despite all its weaknesses, is still the only one that has a foothold in almost all the provinces. Prime Minister Sharif's party is very much a Punjab-based party, and he's now desperately trying to get support in Sindh and in other provinces, but hasn't been able to get much traction. And Imran Khan is at the beginning of his political journey, garnering a lot of young people and their support, as well as some traditional party leaders who have left their parties and have joined him.
Now, he's running a very, I would say, populist, anti-American, nationalistic campaign.
Absolutely. And he is using all the incidents, including Memogate, including the attack on the border posts, to show how strongly he would support the position against the United States, and he's used words to the effect that we should not be fighting America's war. So the public rhetoric and the atmosphere that it's created is really not very conducive to rebuilding the U.S.-Pakistan relationship along the lines that supporters of this relationship had sought. There are going to be grave difficulties in moving to a steady, long-term relationship. I fear that it will, in the end, revert to what it has been, so often in the past, which is a transactional relationship.
So what can be done, Shujan Nawaz, to put this relationship between the United States, this sort of star-crossed relationship between the United States and Pakistan, on some kind of workable footing? We're mentioning Imran Khan running on an anti-American ticket, if you will. The press there is fairly anti-American as well. And the U.S. is now, they used to sort of complain behind the scenes, and now they're complaining openly, at least in terms of Admiral Mullen's testimony about what they consider to be duplicity on the part of their Pakistani allies. So it's fairly poisonous. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of break that can be made that will change this dynamic, because it seems to be sort of on a downward trajectory, I would argue.
There isn't any single silver bullet answer to this relationship. If there had been one, I'm sure that there are very smart people on both sides. They would have found it. There are a number of areas in which both countries, I think, have shared longer-term objectives. The stability of Afghanistan is definitely one of those. The stability of the region is another. The stability of Pakistan is very critical, and I think people in Pakistan as well as in the United States subscribe to the desire for that stability. I think one can start building on those shared longer-term objectives, and then even if you disagree about how you get to those, you're still on the right path. I think that needs to be clearly spelt out so that there isn't a kind of a knee-jerk reaction or tactical moves being made by one side or the other to gain some temporary advantage. What we've seen in the last few years in particular, as the drawdown begins in Afghanistan, as Pakistan's sort of fledgling civilian government is still trying to hang on to power, rather than governing well, there's a tendency to try and garner public support by taking a very strong jingoistic stance, whether it's the civil or the military in Pakistan. That's been their characteristic. And in the U.S., Congress has become very impatient. It wants out of Afghanistan. It's putting pressure on the president to accelerate the withdrawal. And the military is obviously not keen that that withdrawal be accelerated, because they are now seeing some signs that they are getting some traction with their operations against the Taliban, and they've got them on the back foot. So these kind of domestic political considerations are intruding into the Pakistan-U.S. relationship. We haven't mentioned the Kerry Lugar Berman money, which is still not flowing to Pakistan. In fact, as we speak today, not a single penny from the U.S., which is due to Pakistan or promised to the country, has actually gone to Pakistan, because there's a concern on the part of the administration that Congress will see that as a sign of weakness.
Well, I thank you again for joining us, Shujan Nawaz.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Shujan Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan and has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. He is currently the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again all next week covering the major stories of 2011. And until then, have a happy holidays and bye for now.